axis of Hussein, peace being upon him. Today, in the Arbaeen Walk and in this Mokeb, it was shown that Hussein's saga is being honored by our Palestinian brothers. This is a clear reason that depicts the universal aspect of Imam Hussein, showing that he is not specific to a particular sect or religion or group. He's for everyone.
One of the lessons learned from Imam Hussein's revolution is that death with dignity is better than a life with humiliation. And the resistance demonstrated by the brave Palestinian nation in the face of Israeli crimes and oppression is actually similar to that.
Every year during Arbaeen, we are reminded that the lovers of justice and liberation from oppression are in the majority. And this Mokeb is trying to educate people about the atrocities against the Palestinian people and to teach especially the younger generation what the Palestinian cause is. Mahdi Abbasian, Karbala.
As Europe endures its worst energy crisis in 50 years, the French government has promised state intervention will put caps on electricity and home gas prices, but not until next year. France will limit power and gas price increases for households at 15% in 2023. However, the delay means the caps will only arrive after a few more excruciating months, which are likely to see a further boost to the already skyrocketed prices. Many said the plan was not enough, because 15% still represents a massive and historic increase for the average citizen. 15% is almost three times the current and record rate of inflation, and over 40 times the average monthly increase in wages so far in 2022.
Everything is increasing in prices, and everyone sees that, from the average person to the prime minister. The government says the economic and financial context aren't good, but they have used this reason for years in order to avoid helping the average person. We are worried for this winter.
The government received a lot of criticism for not including any new measures to protect consumers at the petrol pump. A recent poll showed that over 40% of France wants a return of the Yellow Vest movement. They began their still ongoing weekend marches in November 2018 due to the high cost of gasoline. Two-thirds of French gas prices are caused by taxes. Gas taxes are regressive and not progressive because they hurt the poor more than they hurt the wealthy.
We see inflation everywhere, at the supermarket, at the fruit stand, but especially with petrol prices. Transportation is so much more expensive. We're told that we simply have to adapt and cut back, but I think the government could have done more to help us.
France is the rare Western nation which has already in 2022 embraced the socialist-inspired concept of state-enforced price caps. The result has been that France has the lowest inflation rate across the entire European Union this year. The newly announced price caps will cost the state 16 billion euros. That amount is dwarfed by the years of neoliberal and austerity-minded measures which have given hundreds of billions in bailouts, tax breaks, and advantages to the wealthy and corporate classes. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Palestinians have held a national conference to mark 29 years since the signing of the Oslo Accords. Hundreds of people attended the conference, demanding the cancellation of the agreements. In September 1993, the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, signed the Oslo Accords with the Israeli regime on the lawn of the White House in Washington, D.C. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas asserted the failure of the Oslo Accords and called on the Palestinian Authority to withdraw its recognition of the Israeli regime.
As we mark the 29th anniversary of the ill-fated Oslo Accords, we call upon the Palestinian Authority to withdraw from the Oslo Accords and to cancel its recognition of the Israeli regime. Today, we also salute the Palestinian resistance, who managed to liberate the Gaza Strip in 2005. Armed resistance is the key to the liberation of all of Palestine.
The Oslo Accords were meant to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but nearly three decades later, Palestinians consider them as a bad chapter in their history. Attendees slammed the Oslo Accords and expressed their support to resistance against the Israeli regime.
The Zionist enemy will never respect any peace agreements and only understands the language of force. We're here to support armed resistance against the Zionist enemy.
Senior officials attending the conference called on all Palestinians to unite their ranks and adhere to armed resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The Oslo Accords were a stab in the back of the Palestinian people. The Zionist regime is a cancer in the region and it must be removed. All forms of resistance must be used against Zionist forces, and armed resistance is the key to defeat the Zionist occupation.
Observers say the Oslo Accords have only brought calamities to Palestinians and have failed to secure the creation of an independent Palestinian state.
29 years on, Palestinians say that peace accords will not free their land, and it's only armed resistance which will help them regain their rights. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
King Charles III proclaimed after 73 years. His life is a complicated story. From his hatred of school as a child, to his high-profile marriage to and divorce from his former wife, Princess Diana, to his affair with his now wife and queen consort, Kamala Parks Owens. Those who believe in him say he put his time to good use, that he'll do well in his role as the monarch. Others say the king is faced with huge challenges. At home, he's facing growing anti-monarchy sentiment as the country grapples with the worst cost of living crisis in decades. Calls from Republicans who say the monarchy is classist, expensive, and outdated.
Are we really now in a place in 21st century Britain where a new head of state is proclaimed, we're told to accept this person without any question?
There's also his relationship with the devolved nations, such as Northern Ireland, with whom the monarchy has had a complicated history, not forgotten by those who bore the brunt of it.
There will never be an acceptance of the monarchy here in Ireland. There's been too much history, too much has been done in the name of the monarchy in Ireland for the Irish people to ever be conscious of that ever happening again.
In Scotland, where the Queen died, independence remains at the center of political debate. The death of Queen Elizabeth II has also revived the debate about the future and unity of the British Commonwealth, a group of 15 independent countries that recognize the British monarch as their head of state.
We've already seen many calls across the Commonwealth for the removal of those particular countries to be removed from the Commonwealth. I think that's going to that's going to be something that is going to be at the top of the agenda over the next couple of years.
Constitutionally, the monarch should be seen and not heard from on contentious issues. King Charles is known to not shy away from expressing his views on a range of topics, such as the environment, new laws, and more. He says he won't do it as sovereign. His critics see it differently.
The new king starts his job in different circumstances than his mother did. An increasing number of Britons are questioning the privileged position of the royal family. The Commonwealth looks set to unravel, and the union of the United Kingdom looks uncertain. Will King Charles III be the last UK monarch? Saipur is up, London.
With record inflation already established and long-term recession looming, few could deny that Europe's sanctions war on Russia has backfired economically so far. A new poll from a top French TV news channel has found that the French have become extremely pessimistic about the conflict in Ukraine and increasingly fed up with the price they have to pay for a country which is not even a part of the European Union or the Eurozone. The poll found that almost 60% want the sanctions on Russia to stop or be reduced if they have too big an impact on the average French person's purchasing power.
Les sanctions et de façon irresponsable et anti-économique.
These sanctions are totally irresponsible from an economic and social point of view. Russia is the only one benefiting from the sanctions, and they've made incredible profits on the increase in oil prices. This is not a situation which can last, given the poor economic state of France and the Eurozone.
France is split almost 50-50 on the question of, has military and financial aid to Ukraine been effective? Almost 85% of those polled think the war will drag on for years.
Je parle des Américains surtout qui poussent. Les Européens, ils suivent comme...
The situation is that the Americans are pushing, and the Europeans are following. Not one American is dying in this war, and they have all the energy they need, unlike Europe. Europe needs to say, no, war is not a solution. And if they don't say this, soon their economies are going to be smashed, and the average person is going to be quite angry with their leaders.
The poll goes against the stated positions of Brussels, Paris, and France's mainstream media moguls, but the economic difficulty of the French working class is extremely hard to suppress. There were over 100 arrests in Paris last weekend at a protest of the economic-based Yellow Vest movement. Many wonder if the French will increasingly brave well-known police and judicial repression in order to protest an unequal economy which appears certain to only worsen. After the coronavirus pause, the Yellow Vests have been marching nationwide every Saturday since their season 2 began in October of 2021. However, French mainstream media have essentially had a blackout on the group since June 2019. While Europe is warning that energy shortages are likely to produce a winter of frosty discontent, the new poll shows a majority of France had already grown weary of sanctions on Russia by the twilight of summer. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
In the limelight.
Business Roundtable aims to weaken efforts that would enable investors to hold companies accountable for their climate promises. We now present you an article written by Adam Lowenstein under the heading, How a Top US Business Lobby Promised Climate Action but Worked to Block Efforts. Three years ago, in a statement, America's most powerful and politically connected corporations promised to protect the environment by embracing sustainable practices across American businesses. The statement on the purpose of a corporation came from the Business Roundtable, an influential Washington, D.C. lobbying group whose 200-plus members include the chief executives of some of the world's biggest companies, such as Apple, Pepsi, Walmart, and Google. Now, on the statement's third anniversary, the Business Roundtable and its member CEOs continue to issue earnest statements about the climate crisis. But the organization is also working diligently and spending liberally to weaken efforts that would enable investors to hold companies accountable for their climate promises. An analysis by The Guardian found the lobby group has worked hard to protect the status quo in which corporations generate goodwill and positive public relations by publishing bold climate goals with little fear of being held accountable or legally liable for achieving those goals. Can choose to selectively disclose certain parts of their carbon footprint or none at all. Are not required to reveal the greenhouse gas emissions generated throughout their supply chains, which for most companies make up the majority of their emissions. Make high-profile pledges to fight climate change while paying to maintain memberships in the Business Roundtable and other trade associations that spend millions of dollars to lobby governments against meaningful climate action. In public, the Business Roundtable's leaders are still committed to change. Doug McMillan, the chief executive officer of Walmart and previous chair of the Business Roundtable, has claimed the climate crisis one of the greatest challenges facing the planet today. In a statement on the group's website, Mary Barra, the chief executive officer of General Motors and the roundtable's current chair, declared that we must act to tackle climate change. Johnson Controls chief executive officer George Oliver, in a video published by the Business Roundtable in January, said the challenge isn't a lack of business commitment, adding, "What we need is to be aligned with the public sector to make sure that we've got the proper policies in place that will enable us to do what we do so well." Yet when the US government has tried to put the proper policies in place, the Business Roundtable has worked to undermine those efforts. In 2021, the organization spent millions of dollars to stop the Biden administration's Build Back Better agenda, which included significant efforts to purportedly reduce carbon emissions and promote clean energy. And this year, after the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, proposed a long-anticipated rule that would require publicly held companies to disclose their carbon emissions and the risk that climate change poses to their business models, the Business Roundtable declared its opposition to central aspects of the Securities and Exchange Commission proposal, including provisions that experts say are vital for the rule to give investors comparable and consistent information about corporations' climate risks. Before releasing the proposed rules in March, the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, had asked the public what such rules might look like. In its response, the Business Roundtable acknowledged that climate challenges are creating growing risks in many parts of the economy and deemed it appropriate for the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, to regulate climate disclosures. The group admitted that the present system of corporate climate reporting, in which some companies issue voluntary climate-related disclosures, has proven inadequate. But when the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, shifted from requesting voluntary input to proposing mandatory requirements for climate disclosures, the organization appeared to change its tune. In a 17-page letter, the chief executive officer, Lobby, announced its opposition to the proposal and asked the commission to revise and repropose the rule. In an email to The Guardian, the Business Roundtable denied that its perspective had changed. It claimed, "Business Roundtable members are committed to combating climate change and are supportive of a rulemaking." The group said, "Our goal is for a pragmatic, attainable and successful rule," adding, "Our members believe it is worth the extra time on the front end to repropose the rule." According to meeting memoranda published by the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, since April of 2021, the Business Roundtable has met at least three times with the SEC about climate disclosures. According to reports compiled by Open Secrets, in the first half of this year, the group sent more than $9.1 million lobbying the federal government directly. In its public disclosures, the roundtable reported lobbying Congress, the White House, and the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Council, about the climate disclosure proposal. In an email, the Business Roundtable said it met with the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, to directly communicate their concerns and shared their point of view with members of Congress and administration officials. Despite asking for a new and thus delayed proposal, the organization's own members continue to assure the public that they see the climate crisis as an urgent challenge. Cummins, chief executive officer and Business Roundtable member Tom Linebarger, said in the organization's January climate video, "We're out of time. We're getting ready to get ready to do things. And the problem is that we have to move now." But now, it seems, does not mean now. One provision the Business Roundtable has rejected as unworkable is a requirement for companies to measure and report the greenhouse gas emissions generated by their suppliers and customers throughout their supply chains, or what are known as Scope 3 emissions. The provision would apply only to companies that have published emission targets that include Scope 3, or for which supply chain emissions are considered material. Scope 3 includes all greenhouse gas emissions that companies neither generate directly, Scope 1, nor purchase for their own energy needs, Scope 2, which means everything from the raw materials that go into creating a product to the transportation that delivers that product to a consumer. For most companies, Scope 3 emissions represents the majority of their carbon output. As Adisu Lashitu, a fellow at Brookings Institution, has pointed out, more than three-quarters of Amazon's 2021 emissions were considered Scope 3. The Business Roundtable supports mandating Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions disclosures, and many companies already report them, in part because these direct emissions are easier to calculate and easier to reduce, sometimes through the purchase of dubious carbon offsets. In its comments to the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, the Business Roundtable called the proposal to require companies to measure and report Scope 3 emissions overly burdensome, because many companies still have limited systems in place to identify and disclose Scope 3 emissions, and some aspects of reporting value chain emissions remain challenging. But Alison Heron-Lee, the former acting chair and commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, told The Guardian, "If you don't have Scope 3 as a requirement, then what you have effectively done is cut out most of the emissions from the top emitting industries, with emissions arguably being the most important item of disclosure for investors. How is a rule without Scope 3 going to achieve what investors need?" The Business Roundtable said in an email, "There is an inherent degree of uncertainty in some of the data the proposal would require companies to disclose, and much of it is largely outside of their control." A number of experts familiar with the Securities and Exchange Council's climate disclosure rulemaking acknowledge that tracking and reporting Scope 3 emissions could indeed be difficult for some companies, or at least more difficult than not doing so. But they suggested that the more fundamental question was not whether complying with the SEC's rules would be more difficult than doing nothing, but rather, if doing so would provide investors with information that they have requested, and that would help them make more informed investment decisions. This argument would appear to align with the stated position of the Business Roundtable, which has repeatedly expressed its support for market-based efforts to address climate change, a view it reiterated in its comments to the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC. George S. Georgiev, a professor at Emory University in Georgia and an expert on securities law, told The Guardian, "Information is the lifeblood of the capital markets, and capital markets are a central institution of a capitalist market economy," adding, "Climate-related financial information is demanded by investors, not by environmentalists. In its comments, the Business Roundtable said that its member companies had already set a high bar for voluntary environmental, social and governance disclosures, or ESG disclosures, and that a voluntary approach to climate reporting was already providing more valuable information for investors. But many investors, analysts and academics, voters and experts, even companies themselves, disagree. Emory University's Georgiev said, "There is near universal agreement among scholars that voluntary disclosure rules alone are not sufficient. The same logic applies to climate rules."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hezbollah's Secretary General has yet again issued a stern warning to Israel. Lebanon will not permit Israel to extract oil and gas from Karish gas and oil field before the resolution of a maritime dispute. The resistance movement has said this is not a threat, but it only wants what rightfully belongs to Lebanon. Could this spell the beginning of yet another conflict between Israel and Lebanon? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the tensions between Israel and Lebanon on this matter, one in which the gas field also belongs to the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip as well. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, joins us from Toronto. Also joining us, Assistant Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Tehran, Arya Barzan Mohammadi, who joins us from Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both. Let me first start with our guest there in Toronto. We're looking at what the Hezbollah Secretary General has said in terms of what he said is not a warning, but basically he just wants what is rightfully for Lebanon, and that is the rights of Lebanon to this gas field. How do you view this situation, given that this dispute now is going on for quite some time?
Yes, well, as far as Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyed Hassan Nasrallah's position is concerned, it is absolutely correct. He is asserting Lebanese rights, which should have been done by the Lebanese government, but unfortunately, the Lebanese government is quite weak. The Lebanese army is unable to implement the rights of the Lebanese people, and so the Hezbollah Secretary General has stepped in. This has actually been going on for quite a while. In fact, as far back as February of 2018, Hezbollah had entered into an agreement with a number of oil companies. These are Western consortium comprising of Total, Eni, and Novatek to explore oil in that area. But then, regrettably, through UN manipulation, Israel used the United States and other Western countries to limit the area that Lebanon's maritime limit is in the Mediterranean Sea. And so this dispute arose at that time. And so Hezbollah has said that if its rights, that means the rights of the Lebanese people, are not respected and guaranteed, then nobody would be able to extract oil and gas from that region, referred to as the Karish field. It's also, the Kanaf project as well, part of it. So this area that comprises several thousand square kilometers, is essentially the area that is under dispute, and Hezbollah wants that resolved before any oil and gas can be extracted from there.
We're going to get into some of those details, but what is somewhat bizarre in a sense, I'm not too sure if I'm using the right word, Mr. Mohammadi, and that is the fact that we're looking at this gentleman, Amos Hochstein, the U.S. mediator for indirect talks on this border demarcation that's happening between Lebanon and Israel, which at this point, though he has tried, it appears to come up with an amicable initiative for both to move on. And there seems to have maybe been some breakthroughs, as it was reported, but nothing tangible yet. The first question, and this may have been answered, but the first question is, how did a U.S. official get involved in mediation between Israel and Lebanon? That is something that plagues some say, the outcome of these talks.
Well, that shows that there is a bigger and larger geopolitical game on the table than the simple dispute between the Zionist regime and the Lebanese government. As you rightly have pointed out, Hochstein is involved since 2018, at least, and Americans are involved. And the thing is, the occupying regime is hoping to build a gas pipeline under the sea, starting even from Egypt, from the Zohr gas fields of Egypt, then joining it to Leviathan gas fields near Gaza, and then also joining maybe Karish gas fields, and then taking it to Cyprus, Greece, and Europe. So this is the big plan according to their roadmap. On the other hand, they are trying to, in a way, follow some normalization steps with the Lebanese government, which Hezbollah, rightly so, is resisting. And normalization comes with some sort of offers of joint venture and also joint projects and also some concessions. They know that the Lebanese government is under financial pressure. And that's also because of the policies of U.S. and some GCC countries. So they are trying to entangle the Lebanese government and Hezbollah in a game of plots and mischievous policies. But I'm sure that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is a clever leader, and he monitors the diplomatic moves by Yair Lapid last week in Egypt, in Germany and France, and also the moves on the sea and the building of platform. And this is why they are sending their drones, unarmed drones, to show that if needed, Hezbollah is more than ready and capable to arm those drones. And also Hezbollah, currently speaking, is standing behind the Lebanese government and Najib Mighati up until the point that they are defending the Lebanese national interest. And if they were successful in, gaining all the benefits that the Lebanese people hope from this gas field, then Hezbollah wouldn't disagree with them. But if they were unsuccessful in securing Lebanese interests, then Hezbollah will take other measures, I'm sure.
Sure. Now, here's where the thrust of the problem is. Hazaf Rabangash, if I may look at it that way, I'm just looking at a very simple outlook here, and that is, obviously, these are not fields that are visible to the eye, per se. So you can't really go and just look and say, okay, this part is mine, this part is yours. The Lebanese demanded 860 square kilometers, to get a little technical here, of territory, and that was according to a map that was sent to the UN back in the year 2011. Now, Lebanon has said that map was actually erroneous in its calculations. So it went ahead. They had companies, Lebanese companies now, it's important, that extracted the maritime area's resources and figured out the dimensions. But then they said that they were threatened by the United States and Israel. So who then can come out and make some exact dimensions that can be accredited and then authorized and then verified and then agreed upon by both parties? You know, that sounds like a Herculean task.
Well, absolutely, yes. But I think there are certain international maritime laws that determine the maritime boundaries of various states around the sea. And it is based on that Hezbollah is making its position quite clear. Because regrettably, the Lebanese government, as I mentioned right at the beginning, is rather weak, and it's unable to assert the rights of the Lebanese people. And so unless and until, this issue of the maritime boundaries is established, then, developing these oil fields, et cetera, or gas fields would make no sense, because this problem would continue. And in this sense, what Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said was that before any exploration takes place, that the maritime boundaries have to be established, demarcated, and established according to international law. And in that sense, since the Zionist regime was trying to play dirty, Hezbollah actually sent a warning in the sense of sending some unarmed drones over that region, over the sea, to show to the Zionists that Hezbollah is quite capable of carrying out operations if the Zionists were to act in a way that would undermine the interests of the Lebanese people. And the Zionists have actually got the message. That's why this American Amos Hochstein has been involved in indirect negotiations, because obviously, you know, Hezbollah would not negotiate with the Zionist regime directly. There was also a report some days ago in Al Rai newspaper that a Middle Eastern envoy has been going back and forth, and he met the Hezbollah Secretary General, requesting him or communicating to him a message from the Israelis that this dispute needs to be deferred for a while until the Israeli elections take place. And the response from Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was very forthright. He said, we are not interested in what the Zionists do, their internal affairs, their elections, etc. To us, it makes absolutely no difference who is in power. They are all outlaws, they are all oppressors, and they perpetrate horrific crimes against the Palestinian people. They usurp the territory of other people. And so we are here to assert our rights, and we demand those rights to be respected. Otherwise, the consequences would have to be borne by the Zionists.
So based on that, then, Mr. Mohammadi, do you think that Israel may be wanting to play somewhat of a delaying tactic, given the fact, for example, the immediate or short term would be the elections, as our guests are indicated? And then overall, when it takes a look at Lebanon, Lebanon's obviously economy is suffering, and energy resources is something that it needs extremely badly for its country. And given that, the U.S. and Israel may be using Lebanon's poor state of the economy, perhaps, to try to not only get concessions, but to give them time to maybe have ulterior motives in this whole scenario, and that is to create instability within Lebanon, maybe.
I agree with you that the Israelis would prefer to delay this issue for a while. One reason or cause is the upcoming election in Israel. And the other one is the failure of Yair Lapid in convincing European leader to invest in this project. They were hoping that because of the Ukraine war, the EU would be very much interested in investing heavily on the gas projects of Israel. But the EU have rejected this for various reasons. One of them is that it will take a long time for any gas field in the Mediterranean, southern and eastern Mediterranean region to be utilized at a level that could replace even 10% of the Russian gas. And the Qatari gas is much more viable option than the Mediterranean one. The other one is that the Europeans prefer to use LNG facilities in Cairo, in Egypt, in order to import LNG gas from the Mediterranean. And this is because they don't want to become independent from the Russian gas and then make themselves under the mercy of another pipeline. So their strategic view of the issue is that use more LNG because it is more replaceable and more mobile than the pipeline. All in all, the Israeli government, the occupying regime government, have decided to put a pause on this issue for a while. But as your guest from Toronto has rightly said so, Hezbollah is not interested in any internal Israeli politics, and they regard this as an utmost issue of national security. And we know that Lebanese government and Lebanese society are in dire need for energy, for fuel, and they wouldn't agree to any deal that would neglect the national interest of Lebanon and the rights of Lebanese people to secure territorial rights in the sea and under the sea and the gas fields. So I think that all the negotiation tactics wouldn't amount to anything tangible in the short term, but in the medium term or the long term, I believe that the U.S. Policy or plan is to use this negotiation as an introduction for some sort of normalization, but in the region. But I'm sure that Hezbollah has a response for every card that the U.S. Tries to play in this regard, and it will use the right tactic at the right time and place.
That's interesting. Trying to figure out the U.S. strategy here, as a Farbangash, perhaps you can help me out with what our guests there indicated about it being in the framework of this so-called normalization. And at the same time, we're looking at a statement made by the U.S. President Joe Biden in August, which is not that long ago, when he discussed this with Yair Lapid, and Joe Biden said and emphasized the importance of concluding these talks and negotiations in the coming weeks. Why do you think there was an assistance by Biden to make sure that this got wrapped up in a rather short period of time, you think?
Well, basically because the Israelis are in a terrible bind, and so is Biden, actually. If we look at American situation, congressional elections are coming up next month, and Biden obviously is under tremendous pressure because he has achieved absolutely nothing in terms of any foreign policy objectives. And there are fears that the Democrats might lose quite heavily in the forthcoming congressional elections. So if Biden were to be able to achieve some kind of an agreement between Israel and Lebanon fairly quickly, then he can present that as a feather in his cap, because the Zionist lobby is very powerful inside the United States. So that's one dimension of it. The other, of course, is that in Israel itself, there is a lot of pressure on the Zionist regime. The Zionists are not able to control the situation. I mean, we saw at the beginning of August, there was a flare-up of attacks against the Gaza Strip, which lasted for 3 days. And yet, you know, the Palestinians, particularly the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, was able to impose certain conditions on the Zionists that they had to accept, which was, for instance, the release of prisoners that are held under so-called administrative detention. We know of Khalil Awawde, who ended his hunger strike a few weeks ago because of the pressure that was built up. And then there are other hundreds of other prisoners that are also being held under administrative detention. Then we see that in the West Bank itself, Jenin has emerged as a very strong resistance point to the Zionist occupiers. And so the Zionists are under tremendous pressure. The Palestinians, by the simple fact that they have not given up despite all of this pressure, is putting tremendous strain on the Zionists. And they are unable to come up with any other answers to a situation that they clearly see is getting out of their hands completely. So it is in this context that obviously Joe Biden was anxious both for his own party's standing in the forthcoming congressional elections, as well as for the Zionists that are facing this tremendous pressure inside their own territory.
Okay, one thing we haven't talked about, and it's not really talked about that often when this issue comes up, and that is the Gaza Strip and the Palestinians and their right to the natural gas, which was found off the shore of the Gaza Strip back in the year 2000, and based on the records, it was licensed to British Gas by the Palestinian National Authority back then. So if we want to take a look at the Palestinians, Chair, Mr. Mohammadi, how do you feel that can be defended in order for them to gain their right? Said Hassan Nasrallah on a few occasions has said that we will come to the defense of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip for their rightful share of the resources there. Do you think that a chance will exist for the Palestinians to actually get a right to that?
Well, Palestinians, especially in Gaza, they are surprising the world every time they get in a war with the Zionist regime. So whether they have several wild cards or surprising tactics in their sleeves, we have to wait and see. But I wouldn't be surprised if they would reveal some new ammunitions or new weapons that could change the game, the plan in the region. The thing is, currently speaking, the Lebanese Hezbollah doesn't have a navy in order to impose things on the Zionist regime. So the most thing they can do is to defend the Lebanese territorial rights in the sea. But for the Palestinians, I think if the Palestinians in Gaza and West Bank, if they decide to resist this looting of the Palestinian wealth, and if they try to show resistance by several means, I'm sure Hezbollah then would be able to come to their aid one way or another. But the thing is, at the moment, people in Gaza are living under a blockade situation. They have they have problems for securing their food and water, and even their security. They are assassinated from time to time. Their leaders are assassinated. The young men are arrested and put on jail. So with regard to the energy situation,
sure,
in the Mediterranean and the right of Palestinians for access to this wealth, I hope that the future will have good news and some surprises,
sure,
in this regard as well for the whole region.
Thank you very much for that. Assistant Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Tehran, Arya Barzan Mohammadi there, and Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash. Thank you, from Toronto. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitapoy and the team, it's goodbye until next time.